Good evening. I will introduce myself, although it's wonderful after so many years to be able to say I know most of the people in the room. It's really great. Sometimes in these different programs I can't do that. But for those of you who don't know me, I am Josie Parker, the director of the library system. And it's my pleasure to welcome you here this evening. I've been looking forward to this program for a long time. I'll start with the business. If you have a cell phone, even if you think you've turned it off, would you check to make sure that you have? And we will be having we're filming tonight's program for future program showings on CTN. And also probably will be a DVD in the library's collection to circulate. And we'll have a question and answer period. And when we do, we'll ask you to raise your hand and someone from the library staff will bring the microphone to you so that your question is recorded. It's also courteous for everyone else in the room, but we have another ulterior motive. We would like to make sure you make it onto the film. I am not a lifelong resident of Ann Arbor. You probably couldn't tell. But I remember moving here 17 years ago in July to a house at the time out on the west side. And the people we bought our home from were lovely people moving to Pontiac with the car industry. And she left us the current issue of Observer on the kitchen counter, with a lovely note about, you will find out everything you need to know about living in Ann Arbor if all you do is read the Observer front to back every month. And I didn't have to, but I choose to. And I'm very grateful that I still receive the Observer in my house now out on Dixborough, and I read it front to back. And I like it, John, very much. It's a pleasure to see the Observer. What I didn't know until I became director of the library and became more involved in the library system is how much history has been incorporated into the work and the writings of the Observer, and how much the fabric of the community has intertwined into those articles, and who the names, and the names meant nothing to me. Metzger's meant absolutely nothing to me. A Metzger grandson is my son's best friend and dates my daughter. I should have paid more attention to the articles about Metzger 17 years ago. But those are the types of fun things that happen when you live in a place long enough and you start reading the articles and you go back. Tonight, we're going to get a glimpse back. Some of you in the room have known Grace and John for a long, long time. I've only had the pleasure of knowing John for a very short period of time and Grace for a little longer. But Grace and I are about to start another project, which I'm going to say out loud tonight, so we'll both be committed. We're going to pick up the library history from the early 80s, where it ended, the last time it was documented, and try to bring it forward. So that will be something else to look forward to. I'm going to leave it to the staff of the library, who are responsible for this great project that you're about to hear about tonight, to introduce our speakers. But again, thank you, and I'd like Amy Cantu and Andrew McLaren, librarians here, to come forward.
Thanks so much for coming. We're very pleased to have author, teacher, and local historian Grace Shackman with us tonight, as well as Ann Arbor Observer editor John Hilton, to help us launch a project that we've been working on for this past year. It's called Ann Arbor Observer, Then and Now, and in a little while you'll get a glimpse of it. We're going to show you some of the articles that are in there. It's browsing and searching access, full text, to over 130 articles on local history that have been written for the Ann Arbor Observer in the past 30 years or so. We'd like to thank, before we get started, we'd just like to thank Grace and John for their cooperation, along with the University of Michigan Press and the Bentley Historical Library for permission to use many of the images that are part of the site. I'd also like to thank AADL staff member Debbie Gallagher for her input and advice, and Ann Martino for her meticulous attention to detail. Grace has written for The Observer, the Old West Side News, and other local publications here in Ann Arbor. She also teaches a class on local history at Washtenaw Community College, and in 2006 published a collection of her work for The Observer under the title Ann Arbor Observed, Selections from Then and Now, published by U of M Press. John Hilton has been the editor of The Observer since the mid-80s, after coming on board under The Observer's original founders, John and Mary Hunt. This year, he was the recipient of the Leader in Literary Arts Award from the Ann Arbor Book Festival. We're going to ask them a few questions to open the floor, and then open the floor for you. and then provide a brief overview of what's available through the website. Please give a warm welcome to John and Grace. So we'll let them get hooked up here and seated comfortably.
As comfortably as you can in front of them.
So as Josie mentioned, I'm happy to bring the microphone around for anybody who has a question, but I thought I'd just toss out the first one to get things rolling, and that is to Grace. Could you just tell us a little bit about how you got it started writing about local history?
Okay, well, can you all hear me? Is my mic on? Okay, this is a question I'm asked often, and of course I laugh about the fact that a lot of people tell me they hate history because they had to memorize all these dates. But I find if you're trying to figure out, like, when did you first start doing anything, it's hard to, like, pinpoint it. But, you know, you could ask how I wrote when I was a kid or how I heard my grandfather's stories or all that. But I do remember a moment when I did that you could call the start. And this is when my daughter Leah, who's sitting there in the yellow sweater, was 3 years old. And I was outside watching her because she was at an age where she didn't just go outside by herself. And I was talking to some other ladies, mothers, and I said, you know, I was talking to Mr. Bauer across the street the other day, and he told me some interesting stuff about how when he first moved in, he lived in his garage, and how he had to go to the corner of Crest and Liberty to get his water, and how there were wildflowers growing in front of the street. And these two ladies said, wow, you should write for the Old West Side News. Like, you know, why I was finding that interesting is maybe another story, or why I said, sure, I'll write for the Old West Side News. I have nothing better to do. I'm just raising two kids and going to school and all this and that. But but anyway, I went to the first meeting. Do you want to follow this up with what was the first article? Okay, I went to the first meeting. I went to the next meeting of the staff of the Old West Side News. And they, the then editor who's since left town, said, well, you know, there are these porches all over town that people have been telling me somebody should write about. These porches that have, like, stone porches that have a circle and then other stones around them that make it look sort of like a sun or a flower. Why don't you write about that? And she said, Carol Hollins had told me that would be an interesting article because her house has those kind of, she's got two porches with those stones. So she said, call her. So I called Carol Hollinshead, the Carol Hollinshead who lives on 2nd and, Jefferson and Bruce Wilson. And she said, oh, yes, they're real nice. You can come see them anytime. But I don't know anything about them. But why don't you call Harry Cook? So I called Harry Cook, and he told me a little bit, and he told me to call his cousin, Carl Cook. And I gathered some information, and then I didn't really have the whole story, but, you know, enough that I wrote an article. And I said, if anyone knows more, call me. And I put my telephone number. This is way before there was email. And I got tons of calls. Everybody knew about this. I mean, there was, this is like in the late 70s, that there were people in the neighborhood who had lived there since before World War II, who had grown up in the neighborhood. And they knew this man, whose name turned out to be George Eberwein, and he worked with another guy named Chris Seeger. And people called me up and they told me, you know, that their garage was, their foundation was repaired by Eberwein, or, you know, other jobs he did besides these porches. And then all this led me to eventually finding his daughter, an old lady, who gave me a picture that I copied. And, you know, this was all heady stuff. It was like, wow, I'm finding out all this stuff, you know, and writing it up. And it wasn't the New York Times, obviously, or even the Observer, but it was like everybody in my neighborhood is like, wow, this is interesting. How'd you find that out? And it seemed like it snowballed from there because all these people calling me had other things to tell me. Did you know that there used to be schools where they taught in German? Or did you know that my grandfather had a dairy right in his barn right in the neighborhood? Or, you know, it just, I'm on a roll here, so I keep going. I've been thinking about it all day. So I was writing about these articles for quite a while. And then people kept saying, well, you should write for The Observer. And I was like, oh, no, I can't write for The Observer. John's been there, too, I know. But What turned the corner, I remember, was my husband told me that somebody at his job had gone to a some service talk, like the Rotary or something, or Kiwanis, and Don Hunt had been talking, and he had said, even though there are all these people in town that think they can write, we have trouble finding people that can write the kind of articles we like for The Observer. And I guess that gave me sort of the courage to to call up. And so maybe I should stop there, you know, but that was how I got started with the... That gets me up to date with The Observer.
Does somebody have a question? I'll bring the microphone around. Okay, how about you, John? How about when you got started working for The Observer?
I'm not sure when exactly I first encountered The Observer, whether it was the first or the second issue, but I was working at the Ford Wayne Assembly Plant at the time and working an afternoon shift that was on a 10-hour shift, so I was getting off work at 4:30 in the morning. Stopping at the Broadway Kroger, for those of us who remember a little more recent history, on my way home to pick up groceries and things. And they had a stand of these observers there. And it was just like, oh, this is such a wonderful thing. And at the time, I thought that I was going to be earning some money at Ford and then following my wife on to a new professional track. So I didn't really think more of it except that I loved to read it. But then at a later point, it turned out that all the Asia librarians in the U.S. were pretty healthy and that my wife wasn't really aggressive enough to knock them off. So we discovered we were going to be staying in Ann Arbor. And at that point, I thought, you know, boy, I'd really love to write for The Observer. And as I said, had the same feeling of grace about, you know, I just can't just go there and actually ask them if I could write for them. So I thought I had to sell an article to impress them first. So I wasted a year, actually, in hindsight, trying to sell an article nationally and finally did that. And then wrote to Don Hunt saying, I sold an article nationally, I'd like to write for you. And he couldn't have cared less about the other article. He wanted to know what I was going to write about for him. And it was an interesting thing because it was a guy that I had known back in Vail House Co-op back in the early 70s who had developed a business making bicycle luggage. Back when he had this lovely room under the oak tree in the corner of Vail, he had a little old-fashioned treadle sewing machine and he'd been stitching little little belt bags and things. And then he'd paired up with an engineer, and they were actually doing this carefully engineered cantilevered. They were suspended. There was a tension element in them so that they were stretched and were perfectly designed and one thing and another. And so they had a whole business out on Jackson Plaza, out behind the car dealerships off Jackson there. And I said, you know, how about if I write about Leslie and his business? And Don thought that was interesting, so I wrote that article, and I continued to freelance for a couple of years. And then finally they said, okay, we're going to hire you, and we can't afford to hire you as a writer, but how about you set up a circulation system for us and do delivery for us, because we think that we could do that better than we're doing. And so I did a detailed study of that, and I gave Don the results, which weren't what he was hoping for in terms of what a fabulous deal it was going to be to do it ourselves. But in the meantime, he'd persuaded me to write an insider's view of what did and didn't work at the Ford Motor Company on the assembly line. And so I was still at the Ford Motor Company when that article came out. Which was an interesting time. Fortunately, not too many people at the Wayne Assembly Plant read The Observer, so it took a while to get around. But a few months after that, Don decided he could afford to have a writer, and he hired me as a writer, and I've been basically writing and editing for The Observer ever since.
Grace, if you have this list of ideas that people have given you over the years of things to write about, how do you choose what you're going to write about? Does one thing just strike you one day?
That's an interesting question. I always have this huge list. I mean, you wouldn't believe what a big list. But if someone says, I have some pictures, and my grandma can tell you all about X, that article goes to the top of the list. If it's a very vague thing, it takes a while. You know, sometimes something, John and I always talk about trying to fit it, too, with something that's happening now, you know, so that people are interested. Like I wrote about the old County Road Commission building on Washington, because they're still deciding what to do with it. Or sometimes things make it to the top of the list because people are always asking about it. Like one of the articles that I like that I wrote. Well, I suppose I like them all immodestly, but was the Underground Railroad article. And that one, no one told me that they knew anything about it. I mean, it was pretty much unknown territory. But what got me going was that so many people asked me about the Underground Railroad. And I used to have a regular thing on the Ted Heisel show when Ted Eisel was still alive. For those of you who don't know what it was a call-in show, and he'd have me on once a month, and I'd come in with a topic, often something I was writing for The Observer, and people would call in, Bob Kuhn among others, and, you know, give me information. I'd say, well, where were all the gas stations, or how did people get coal? Or I remember one that Ted thought wouldn't work at all. I'm digressing again, aren't I? With stained glass windows. But people called in with lots of interesting information about stained glass windows. But anyway, it seemed like all the time people were calling in asking me about the Underground Railroad. So I thought, well, maybe I should write about the Underground Railroad. So I checked with John, of course, and it was fine with him. And I thought, well, I'll take about a month and I'll find out which houses people think are those kind of houses, are Underground Railroad stops, and sort of evaluate whether they might have been, and that'll be that. Well, I remember I worked on it 5 months. It was a real interesting challenge to try to make a story out of a sort of situation where there's a lot of smoke but no fire. But it was also interesting, and the library was an enormous help. Betty Thompson was still working at the reference desk, and she got from interlibrary loan all kinds of great books for me. Like there was somebody in Ohio who had tried to collect the names of Underground Railroad stops before they were all dead, you know, in the like 1890s. And she got me that book from some other library and things like that. But so the way I choose these articles, in other words, is probably as many articles as I have, there's a story on each one, you know, why I chose it. And I'll never run out. I mean, I still have a huge list.
John, do writers always come to you with the ideas, or do you get a list of things that people want to learn about from local history and go find someone to write that topic?
With local history, that's typically not the case where I have something on my wish list. Although actually, I guess the We Almost Lost Carytown article, that was an exception where somebody outside of Grace actually did a story on it, and it was interesting history that I'd been aware of myself only because going back through the records of my own house, I could see that it was supposed to have been demolished back in 1957 for urban renewal. And we'd never really gotten the full story on it. And so Eve actually took that one on. And that was the rare case where that was something that I knew I wanted to know about, because usually, you know, you don't know what the story is. You don't know what's going to be interesting about something until you're into it. So for local history, it's almost always either somebody wants to know or somebody has a story they want to tell. Other things, you know, there's lots of questions that people have and say, you ought to do a story about this and that, and that's another issue. But for local history, it's almost always that someone's told Grace a good story or she's thought of a question that she wants to answer.
Well, I wanted to ask either of you, has there been that story that you just really wanted to grab onto but you just could never find the answers to write it, or are there mysteries unsolved here?
No, but there's always articles that you someday want to write if you just could. And an example of one that I thought was going to elude me but luckily didn't was the Frank Lloyd Wright House, a woman named Mary Palmer and William Palmer. He's now dead, but they owned it. And I was It's the only real Frank Lloyd Wright house in town, and I knew about it, and I'd met her several times various ways, and she always resisted me writing about it because she's sort of a private person. And finally, one time, I hit on an idea of asking her. I said, Mary, what if I wrote it like about what this house means to other people? Because she didn't want it to be so much about her. And she agreed, yeah, that would work. And so I talked to everybody who'd been in there for some reason or another or had something to do with it. But it also was quite a bit about her. But that was one I was so glad that I was able to do. But there's many times when I read the obituary column and I'm sad not just that somebody died, but, you know, that it's somebody that I always wanted to talk about. So, yeah, there's always going to be a lot of those stories around. We could have a whole team of local history people, you know, going out and trying to talk to everybody. You just talk to people who are willing, let alone the ones who aren't willing.
With the imminent demise of the Ann Arbor News, is the Observer going to be undertaking some roles that it hasn't had in the past or be expanded?
we wish we could be expanding. We're feeling, to a lesser degree, the same things they're feeling. We're actually shrinking and have been shrinking pretty much for the past year. Because we're 100% ad-supported, the amount of editorial space we have is a direct function. It's literally, I put the ad pages into a spreadsheet, and that tells me how big an issue I have. So what we've been doing in the actually pretty much since the start of this year is trying to bring things back into balance. What had happened was that in past years, I'd always given John Hinchey, our calendar editor, a fixed allocation of space, and I'd given him that space a year in advance. And essentially, as the issues reduced size, we were finding that we were becoming more and more calendar and less other articles. So John has been doing a fantastic job of reorganizing and rewriting the way in which he conveys the calendar material, giving us more editorial space. So we're trying to use that space as well as we can to cover more newsy topics. And in fact, probably Grace has suffered more than anybody. We've probably had fewer history articles, actually, in the last couple of years, trying to give more priority to news stories. But in terms of basic format, in terms of what we're trying to do, we're not going to really reconceive the magazine. We're just going to try to make the best use of the available space.
John, basically I'm an Ann Arborite, and one thing that I always enjoyed in the Ann Arbor News, and there's still a lot of people around that are Ann Arborites like I am that look back in the Ann Arbor history. The Ann Arbor News used to have a little article, probably about 6x6 or something, of Ye Olde Editor. Uh-huh. Now, this, as far as I was concerned, was one of the nicest things that the Ann Arbor News printed, because I could look and read that article back in 1876, and my dad was shot hanging, or he was, did something, or somebody did something and something and something. And that brought back history, not only the history, but the time element. And you still have a lot of Ann Arborites still alive.
Thank goodness.
That enjoy that type of a program. Now, I don't know if you can use articles out of the news and reprint them without some type of a lawsuit or something, but what I'm saying is that this is something that local people would enjoy, the past history. And I think that I've thought about that for a long time, that maybe somebody would come up with some idea that they could at least bring back past history in a little 6x6 box or something like that. Yes. Now, I know that the, what is it, that other magazine that we get, Independent Times, they go back on a whole history of VJ Day and all of that. They're all listed what happened on that date and time. Now, that's most interesting. And I think people enjoy something like that. But I would like to see something like that in the Observer. I enjoy the Observer very much. And Grace does a nice job, and so do your other people that write for you. But I think Grace could do more if she wanted to, but she doesn't.
Well, it really is true that history articles have been one area that we have done more of in the past, as we had more available space and have had to compress. And it's an interesting question, is there a way to do it in a shorter space? Right. We don't have the legal right to simply go back and excerpt things from the past. Right. In fact, typically, if Grace is putting together an article, she will talk to people, she will read, she'll have a quote here, a quote there from something that was a written source from a spoken history that she's gotten. But we don't really have the, we don't have the archive either, although who knows, with the Ann Arbor District Library on the case, perhaps at some point that will be online. But I understand what you're saying, because it is wonderful to see those little vignettes. I actually got my new Scientific American yesterday, and it's actually my favorite section. It's what was 150 years ago? What was hot science then?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, really? That's how you thought it worked.
Somebody else have a question? For Grace, what's the most surprising discovery you made during your research for an article?
Oh, yeah. Well, you sent me a few questions ahead of time, and that was one of them, but I thought you meant I thought of an answer, but in a more general way.
It's fine.
I mean, every article you talk to people, and you've got all this pile of notes, and it's not making sense, and it would just be boring if you just wrote A, B, C, D, and you wait for that moment when you, like, you know, it hits you like, oh, yeah, I see why that happened. And so there are a lot of those small moments, like I could tell you the first one, maybe, starting with the, going back to the old West Side News, when I got done with the big porches, somebody else called me and told me that her porch was made with these littler stones. And she had actually found the guy who did it. And he lived in Chelsea. And she said, maybe if you want, I'll drive you out there and we can go talk to him. So he's a guy named Cub Vogel. And I found out later when I started studying Chelsea more systematically that he did a lot of the porches in Chelsea too. But anyway, he's just talking about how he laid out the stones and blah, 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 and I'm taking notes. And all of a sudden he said something very interesting. He said, now I use these little stones because the big stones were all taken. Like when people cleared their fields when they were first farming, they take out these big stones and the stonemasons could cut them in these nice big squares or rectangles that you see all over the 19th century homes. But he's doing it in the 20th century and there were just these little stones. So that's why he had to do the little stones. And I go, oh, that's very interesting. And he told me, go to the Chelsea Cemetery, and you can see the old part had these big stones, and then the newer part, which he had done, the pillars, had these little stones. So, yeah, I don't know what's the most surprising, but many articles have these moments when you are surprised.
All these, I've been meaning to ask you, Grace, do you... Which have been among articles that caused, like, the most heat? I know people would call on the Ted Heisel show and get quite excited.
Oh, dear. I don't write very controversial articles. And if people say to me, I don't want this, don't write that down, or off the record, I just put my pen down because I don't want to be tempted. You know, okay, tell me if you want to, but it won't go in the article. And usually it's something that has nothing to do with, people sometimes get annoyed at something that you wouldn't think they would, and yet you'd put controversial things in, and they're fine with it. So, well, you know yourself from all your writing. So it's hard to tell ahead of time what people might like and what they won't like. I remember it's funny how you're imprinted in these earlier, I'm thinking back in the early days, the article I'm talking about, the stones that I put in, the little stones that I just told you about, that lady, she was Eleanor Kuhn. Her husband was chairman of the Old English Dictionary, and they lived in the Old West Side when that wasn't a fashionable place to live. People are always asking them, why are you living here? Which is another whole story, how the town has changed. But she was the one who called me, and she's the one who took me out to Chelsea, and she's the one who I talked to. And so I wrote the article, you know, quoting her and talking about her house and stuff. And she later told me that she was annoyed that I didn't mention her husband. So, I mean, that kind of stuff happens all the time. But generally it's not, nothing too major.
Yeah, and I have another question for you. In regards to Ann Arbor history, like what Grace does, are you going to try to continue that type of a page for the local people at Ann Arbor history of this and that? Now, for example, people my age are dying off, and they, in turn, they're sold their businesses. I'm thinking of, for example, Bud Stein. Stein and Gates now become the Emden. Bud is still alive. There's the Nichols RK. Some of the Nichols family are still alive. In fact, that arcade is quite a history on the building itself. the way they designed it and how many years ago, I don't know, Grace maybe knows, but there's a lot of history in that building because I think it came from Europe, the design or something to that effect. But all I'm saying is that there's people that have had businesses and they're sold and they're still doing good, such as Emden, and yet there's a history up to that point. And I think that that's a good page for older people to gain and keep up the information, or for Grace to get the information at the time.
We definitely want to keep doing history stories, and that's one of the reasons we're trying to loosen up some other space in the issue. Actually, a little bit of the Stein and Gates history just got into marketplace changes recently because of the MDIM. You know, they've actually bought what many of us still think of as the old Borders store on State Street, and that was a chance to tell some of that history. And you know, the nice thing about the history too is that it's not just of interest to people who were there. You know, when it's told properly, what history is it's the human experience. It's something that affects all of us, and often in history you can actually get a better sense of that story than you can in this moment, where people maybe for various political or personal reasons may be a little reluctant to tell you what was really going on. So a good history story, to my mind, is not of interest just to older people, but you know, I know that, like Grace, I found that I was really fascinated by it at a very early point reading about it. And I think that, you know, that's certainly my hope for our history stories, is that they reach that wider audience too and help them understand how the city got to be as it is and some sense of how it may develop going forward.
Especially when the people are still alive that had the business. Yeah. It's hard for Grace to go back to the cemetery and try to get information.
Sad, but true. You can't.
Oh, yeah,
back.
You don't know how many times people say to me, oh, my mother knew all about that. But she's been dead the last 10 years. And it's like, yeah, I can't have a seance or anything.
I found out there's another observer. I found it out just recently. It's probably been published for many years, and I missed it. The Community Observer.
That's right.
Oh, yeah.
And Grace writes for that, too. You wrote an article about the East Delhi Bridge there.
Yeah, I did.
And the secret is that you can find it in the Chelsea Library, so I know how to find it. What's the relationship of the two? Is the Community Observer a child of the other one?
Yes, it is. And it actually goes back to a decision that my partner Patricia Garcia and I made fairly early on. When we took over the Ann Arbor Observer, it was really distributed just within the city of Ann Arbor. And as the sort of, as the larger sprawl, if you will, expanded beyond the city limits, we expanded with it to the point where we were covering not just the city of Ann Arbor, but any place that has an Ann Arbor mailing address, which actually is quite an extensive area. It goes way out Jackson Road and a good chunk out to the east and south as well, or that is part of the Ann Arbor School District. And so the circulation rose from something like, I think, 47.5 when we started up into the 60s. And at that point, we had to say to ourselves, okay, we've hit everything that you could call Ann Arbor. What's our next step? And we really thought about it quite a lot, and we decided that it didn't make sense to keep expanding the Ann Arbor Observer circulation into areas that had their own identities, their own historic identities. It seemed like we were asking a lot of Chelsea or Dexter to feel that they should be a small part of the Ann Arbor Observer. And so after quite a bit of thinking about it, we decided that we would create a publication like the Ann Arbor Observer, but specifically focused on those nearby communities, which had, you know, roughly the same scale, much of the same history, as Grace has been able to tell us over the years. I remember her story on telephone operators small towns back when.
That was fun. Well, and Bob gave me the idea because he used to work for the telephone company.
Ah, okay. Yep. So it is an analog of the Ann Arbor Observer, but just as the Ann Arbor Observer is all about, I tell people, you know, we'll write about anything that happens within the boundaries of our coverage area and nothing outside it. And the same is true of the Community Observer. The only difference is that they're adjacent areas.
Before we let you go, John, I wanted you to tell us what makes Grace a great local history writer.
Well, that's assuming he thinks that.
he keeps publishing.
I would like to go on record here and now that Grace is a great local history writer, and it's partly because she just takes that pleasure in finding stories. She really wants to know how things happened. There's the two different elements, as anybody can tell you. You know, you have to learn things, then you have to find a way to tell them. And Grace is great at both of them. You know, she really started out just as somebody who was curious, and she's become a good storyteller too. And once you have those two things together, you know, there's just no end to the good stories because, well, there's just so many stories that haven't been told yet. You know, it's just, it's mind-boggling how little we've scratched of this whole subject.
Yeah.
We'd like to thank both of you, both Grace Shackman and John Hilton, for coming and joining us today and talking a little bit about your experiences at The Observer. And now if you'd like to have a seat down here, everyone applaud for them first. They did a great job for us.